This week's program is about what I call temporal provincialism. And this is a term that I hope will catch on, because in the 50s I used to refer to New York City provincialism, and everybody, as I said before, looked at me like I had a tulip growing out of my nose, because back then the one thing New York City was not was provincial. A lot of people say they believed in the old-time religion and so forth, but New York City was modern and sophisticated, even to the people who disagreed with it. So we all know what provincialism is. I think nowadays nobody would have any trouble with the term temporal of New York City provincialism, but back then, as I say, it was a weird idea to people. I would refer routinely when I was 20 years old to communism as a religion. Nobody has any trouble with that these days, but back then again, it took a lot of explaining. Now, the other type of provincialism is what I'm trying to describe now. And let me start by pointing out that we live in a four-dimensional world. There's up and down, forward and back, left and right, and the fourth dimension is time. So if you vacate your location by going forward or backward or left or right or up or down, somebody else can step into it, and in another time, someone else is going to step into your space. So we have four dimensions here. But provincialism is always considered a matter of the first three dimensions, especially the left and right and forward and back. That is to say, a provincial is someone who thinks that everything happens in his location, meaning his location in space. So while to my mind, everything important happened in Pontiac, South Carolina, the rest of the world used to think that everything important happened in New York City or Paris. These were locations on the map, but people have gotten used to the idea that if you think everything important happens in New York, or if you think that everything important happens in Paris, or that the opinion in New York is true opinion, or the opinion in Paris is true opinion, then you're a provincial. That's what a provincial is someone who thinks that his location in space, his city, or his country, is where everything important happens and where people believe only the truth, whereas in other places, they don't believe the truth. But what about this fourth dimension, time? What if you believe that all truth is embodied by your time? That's as provincial as believing that all truth is embodied in your location, in space. We're talking about another dimension. So someone who uses the word modern all the time, or this is 2005, or something like that, is being just as provincial as someone who says, we're in Frankfort, Kentucky, and all truth is in Frankfort, Kentucky. There's no difference between the two types of provincialism. But using the word modern is not considered provincial. But it is. It's totally provincial. It is simply temporal provincialism, not locational provincialism. Provincialism is believing that your place and your time has the truth. Now, I have lived in many modern worlds. I remember reading Will Durant, who was writing in the late 40s, And one of his statements ending a chapter was about some philosopher he liked. He said, he is as modern as British socialism. He is as current as Karl Marx. Now, he meant that seriously, because we were talking about 1950, and the latest thing in 1950 was British socialism and Karl Marx. Well, nowadays, I think we all sort of take it for granted that the Soviet Union is hopelessly out of date. Russians are trying, and Eastern Europe are trying desperately to catch up with the modern world, and we're stuck in communism, which was as out of date as Tsarism, and countries are adapting to the market system, and that's considered very modern in our day. Whereas in 1950, capitalism and the free market was considered totally out of date. Modern was Marx. Modern was the British socialism. Now, someone has said, and I'm putting it a different way, that history, a real historian, when he studies history, he's not studying the past. He is studying someone else's present. He is studying someone else's modern day. Now, I've lived in a lot of modern worlds. The modern world changes pretty regularly. I remember a movie called The Boston Strangler that had Tony Curtis and it had Henry Fonda. And it was about 1968, and it was based on the latest modern ideas. The Boston Strangler emphasized the idea of 1968 that criminals, who we call those so-called criminals, are actually disturbed people who are the victims of society. That was the modern idea in 1968. If you looked at that movie just 5 or 10 years later, you would think, my God, this thing is sexist, incredibly sexist, because the women who were being killed by the Boston Strangler were sort of stage dressing. Nobody talked about them as being human beings at all. And the entire movie was about how pitiful and disturbed the Boston Strangler was, how pitiful and disturbed all of the male suspects were. It was a totally male-oriented movie. And the women who were killed were sort of, oh well, you know, you got to have somebody killed so that you can talk about how badly the so-called criminals are treated. And as I say, within 5 or 10 years, the whole modern approach changed, and that movie wouldn't have been at all the same just 5 or 10 years later. I have lived through many modern worlds. I wrote a piece for the Southern Partisan magazine back in the late 70s, early 80s. It was called The Partisan Dictionary, and I would define words like Ambrose Bierce did in kind of funny ways. And one word that I defined, I had modern, and I defined it as becoming dated, meaning that whatever is modern is going to be out of date pretty soon. But the temporal provincial simply cannot absorb that idea any more than New Yorkers in the 1950s could absorb the idea of New York City provincialism. We all hear the old voices who used to dominate network news, and there were only three networks, crying over the fact that professional journalists like them are ignored, while the internet is providing all this non-professional stuff. Well, as usual, I was ahead of that curve. Back in about 1980, I wrote in the Partisan Dictionary, I define the word professional journalist, the term professional journalist. I define a professional journalist is someone who dedicates his entire life to trying to find out 10 minutes before someone else does what everybody will know tomorrow. And that's all these professional reporters dedicate their lives to, trying desperately to get something which is a scoop. Now, a scoop is by definition something that will be on the headlines tomorrow all over the world. But the big thing, the thing that makes it a scoop, is you find it out 10 minutes earlier. I am still mystified as to the difference between this and the neighborhood gossip. It seems like a ridiculous thing for a grown man to spend his entire life trying to find things out 10 minutes earlier than other people do. But the latest news has the same sort of charm that New York Opinion had in the 1950s. And I hope that we will outgrow this. Knowing the latest news is a big deal if you're getting paid for it. But if you're trying to figure out the world and you're sitting there with your tongue out checking on the latest news from Iraq, then you're not living in the same world I do. You're a hopeless provincial. You're just a temporal provincial. You know, it's hard to believe today that back in the 30s and 40s, history books were bestsellers. This wasn't just because people were more interested in history then. It was also because historians were much better writers then. Because in order to be a professional historian today, you have to prove that each person you're talking about in history contributed to reaching our present state of wisdom, to modern thought. So anytime somebody talked about slavery the wrong way, or women the wrong way, or Jews the wrong way, or whatever the wrong way, and the wrong way changes, then the historian has to apologize for that misstep. And political correctness is the ultimate in temporal provincialism. Every writer of history has to show how his particular characters, or the development of history that he's talking about, helped to reach our present state of wisdom, our modern state of wisdom, which is, of course, political correctness. As I said, the 1968 movie The Boston Strangler would have been an entirely different movie 10 years later because it was so hopelessly sexist. But at the time, that reflected politically correct opinion and politically correct thought. So the Henry Fonda character, who was worried to death about so-called criminals and had all the sympathy in the world for them and didn't give a damn about the women who were being murdered, was the modern thinker of 1968. Around 1972, several ugly women got together, including Bella Abzug of New York, congresswoman from New York City, and announced that they were the women's movement. And ever since, they have been the women's movement. Now, the National Organization of Women is much smaller than a lot of the memberships of paid-up, family-values-conservative women's groups. But as one head of one of those women's groups point out, one of the best-kept secrets in America is that ours is the largest women's organization in America. Because women means liberal. It means the women who formed the movement in one press conference with Bel Abzu. I think there were four or five of them. And after that date, liberalism changed, and the movie The Boston Strangler would not have been politically correct. It would not have been modern after 1972. That's why I keep saying 5 to 10 years after 1968. So modern changes all the time. Now, another little secret of this is that modern changes all the time for both sides. Once you get used to the idea that modern is a thoroughly provincial term, you also realize that another magic word for truth, justice, and the American way, that word being moderation, is also a piece of thorough temporal provincialism. In the 16th century, if you had tried to find the truth by finding the middle of the road, say in England, you would have the Catholics on one side and the Protestants on the other. Two groups of people who were busy running theocracies and who were busy burning each other alive. And you would say, well, that's both sides, so the truth must be somewhere in the middle. Well, the middle is just as outdated as either side is. This is rather obvious, and it kind of makes me feel a little crazy to have to explain it. But our whole dialogue revolves around what is modern opinion, what is moderation, what is the middle of the road. And these are absolutely silly, childish terms. If liberalism is absurd, then the conservatism that has grown up for the specific purpose of arguing seriously with the silly liberalism of our day must be silly too. This isn't a great insight, this is simply the way the world works. The people who are in between burning Catholics alive and burning Protestants alive are totally out of date in the next age. You don't find the truth in the middle of the road of your day. You don't find it on one side, you don't find it on the other side, and you don't find it in the middle. Only if you are truly obsessed with what you call modern thought can you actually believe that the truth is somewhere between the two extremes of your particular point in time. Now, what exactly is the difference between believing that the truth is somewhere between the two extremes in your particular community, that is, the truth for the whole world is to be found in your community, it's just to be found between the two sides in your particular community. Everybody would recognize that's very provincial. But nobody recognizes that the idea that truth is to be found between the two extremes in your time, between what Jesse Jackson calls both sides in your time, that's a thoroughly provincial idea. But, once again, just as I got that look, like I had a petunia growing out of my nose back in the 1950s when I talked about communism being a religion or New York City provincialism, I get that same tulip growing out of my nose when I mention that people are being provincial when they say that moderation is the key, that somewhere between the two extremes in the time in which we live, the truth exists. That is as thoroughly provincial as thinking that the truth is somewhere in New York City. But in order to make your living as a professional journalist, you have to be 1,000% a temporal provincial. If you want to excite people on the internet, you have to talk about the latest news. Whereas if you want to be a non-provincial, you end up making mistakes that strike the temporal provincials as absolutely inexcusable. I made an entire speech in Washington once about, I'm not sure it was in Washington, it doesn't make any difference, but I kept referring to Bill Clinton as Jimmy Carter. Now, in my historical perspective, the electoral process in America is stuck in a groove. There has not been a single Democrat elected to the presidency since 1960 who was not from a state in the old Confederacy. Lyndon Johnson was from Texas, Jimmy Carter from Georgia, Bill Clinton from Arkansas. On the other hand, the Republicans have been, although of course I have a certain preference for my old boss, Ronald Reagan, simple fact is that each Republican has been a sort of faceless attempt to play somewhere between the truth and the Democrats. So, to me, Jerry Ford and George Bush, Senior and Junior, were more or less the same people. Jimmy Carter was a Southerner who was a good liberal and managed to get the right electoral balance because the South has been the swing vote in every election since, I guess, 1950. Although people didn't notice it, it was the truth. And so the Democrats have never won unless they nominated someone who was not only a Southerner, but from the Deep South or from the most rural state in the Union, which is Arkansas. To my historical point of view, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton represented the same electoral strategy, the same electoral mentality, which of course is what I always got paid for figuring out. And poor old Jerry Ford and Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. represent the same pitiful Republican who is trying to play between his desire to get that minority vote and some principles which are supposedly conservative, that are supposed to get conservatives mobilized on his side. It's the same game. It's like a stuck record to me. To other people, Iraq is the thing. If you can find out something about Iraq, find out that George Bush has foot odor and lies, you can spread it all over the internet and everybody will be panning to see what you have to say. My problem is that I lived through Korea, Vietnam, the last Iraq war, and this Iraq war, and as far as I'm concerned, nothing has changed. I can confuse the groups because they're so much the same from my non-provincial point of view. If you really want to understand my viewpoint, let's translate temporal provincialism into territorial provincialism. What if every news service and every email and every blog discussed nothing but opinion in New York City. Those blogs and those journalists would say, the truth is somewhere in New York City. There's an extreme left in New York City. There's a right in New York City. Let's find out what the truth is. We will not have any journalists or any commentators anywhere but in New York City. Yes, we recognize the rest of the country exists. Okay, we've recognized that. Now let's talk about New York City. That would be considered slightly insane. And yet, that is exactly what we do in terms of time. We have everything concentrated on what is happening right now. We think that the truth is somewhere in the thought right now. It is somewhere in the extremes of opinion right now. I am not saying that that is unwise. I am saying that that is a truly fruitcake point of view. I am going to do a piece in my blog called News Hooks and Blindsiding. You can reach my blog by going to WhitakerOnline.org and hitting on Bob's blog. News Hooks and Blindsiding. I think that we all know what a news hook is. What you do if you're a professional journalist or someone who is panicking over the latest news from Iraq or the fact that George Bush has foot odor or the astonishing fact that politicians lie. What you do is you use whatever just happened, the latest news, as your news hook. And then you philosophize from that news hook you've got. But it has to be news. It has to be modern. It has to be right now. And I think we know what blindsiding is. I used to play football, and I had some uncomfortable experience with blindsiding, meaning you're looking the other way and somebody knocks the hell out of you from another direction. And of course, we're always getting blindsided. We find that while all our attention was concentrated on the impeachment of Bill Clinton for being a nasty little man, meanwhile, all these terrorists were developing in the Middle East. But there was no news hook for the Middle East. The big thing was that Clinton was being a bad boy. So we get blindsided because the problems that are developing out in the Middle East suddenly exploded, quite literally, when those planes hit the two towers. But we had all been worried about our news hooks and the news, Bill Clinton with his pants down. And while everybody is worried about Iraq, and everybody is using Iraq as a news hook, we're going to get blindsided by problems developing in other places because a wise journalist or a wise emailer or a wise blogger is going to be absolutely obsessed with news hooks. What's the point in writing something that sounds theoretical or irrelevant to today's news? Why should you be pontificating about things that are not relevant to today's news. And that is as true of the average blogger as it is of the average newsman. The people who call themselves professional journalists, they're all ridiculous. And they always get blindsided because they're all looking for the latest thing. They're all temporal provincials. And they are not talking about things that people would consider theoretical or irrelevant or out there in terms of time or in terms of space. Back in 1998, while the question of Bill Clinton having his pants down in the White House was the only issue anybody was interested, I wrote a Whitaker online called Super Terrorism. It was an imposition on my readers because it had nothing to do with Bill Clinton or his pants down or Monica Lewinsky or anything that was actually important at the moment. What I was observing was that terrorism was becoming easier. One of the reasons terrorism is becoming easier is because of a little matter of spinning in a chemistry lab. You can separate very easily, for example, a heavy dirt from water by spinning it. But one of the things that keeps people from taking U-238 and separating out the U-235 that makes an atomic bomb is the fact that it's very hard to spin something hard enough to separate out the very similar elements of U-235 from U-238. But if you get 8 kilograms of U-235, you have yourself an A-bomb. You can look up the details for the rest of the process on the internet. Well, I noticed that kind of thing. I know it isn't the latest news hook, so I threw it in that week, and I'm sure a lot of the readers considered it an imposition. But after the attack on the Twin Towers in 2001, I reprinted it because it was talking about something that had blindsided America. Again, terrorism using modern methods. In this case, planes which were full of gasoline, and gasoline has 60% of the explosive power of TNT. Well, this is all sort of technical stuff, and it has nothing to do with a news hook, but all of a sudden, as I say, it quite literally exploded on the scene. We got blindsided again. So, I do tend to get a bit theoretical about things, and I do tend to confuse Carter with Clinton, because in longer-term historical terms, if your entire focus is on what happened last, then this is absurd to worry about things like that. But Carter and Clinton, to me, historically speaking, will be looked upon by historians in the future as a very similar phenomenon, very hard to separate out. Today, we don't really worry ourselves sick about the difference between Benjamin Harrison and President Hayes or President Chester A. Arthur. They were all sort of Republicans in the post-Civil War era because they're the same pattern. They don't really matter as personalities in the long term of history. we have an impossible time of recognizing that the differences between Carter and Clinton, or between Gerald Ford and George Bush Sr., are of no importance whatsoever. What we have to worry about is that which might blindside us. The problem being that when someone like me starts talking about what might blindside us, people turn back to the people who have news hooks and who are interested in modern issues and what is going on right now. So while everybody else is worried about news hooks, let me talk a little bit about what is going on right now in a non-temporal provincial world. There is a growth, as the Anti-Defamation League says, of anti-Semitism throughout the world. Anti-Semitism used to be a right-wing thing, and of course nobody would dare call anything left-wing anti-Semitic. But it was the French ambassador to the United States who referred to Israel as a S dot dot dot, I think it's an S asterisk 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 Y, little country. The fact is that anti-Semitism is growing on the left and on the right. In fact, the only people who adhere to the old idea that Jews are angels is the religious right and the neoconservatives. And the religious right, though nobody seems to notice it, is being torn to pieces electorally. They are quite simply dying, partly because of their absolute dedication to the Old Testament and to Jews. No one called this anti-Semitism. But I have spent a lifetime in politics, and nobody ever calls anybody by anything by its name in politics. If you're going to be in politics, you have to be able to translate, and translate fast. Someone else can sit around and say, well, that's not exactly the same thing. But if you don't realize that's the same thing, you don't keep your job. Nobody is allowed to be so naive that they don't understand that there is a growing hatred for Jews in general on both the left and the right in the world today. Now, what I understand as anti-Semitism is not what the average person would see as anti-Semitic. Some years back, 20 years ago, I guess, I was going through yet another tippy-top secret clearance, meaning the top secret clearance that I had to go through so many times. And tippy-top secret is not what you're going to hear from any official wording, but once again I was getting my tippy-top secret, and the adjudicator was Jewish. Well, when you're sitting there getting your tippy-top clearance, the adjudicator has behind him a very large round table. In my case, it was a round table of notebooks which detail everything about you, your childhood, and everything about you. So I didn't have a hell of a lot of secrets left about me personally. So he asked me, are you anti-Semitic? Well, now, if I had said no, he could have caught me for lying, because under the official definitions of anti-Semitic, I definitely was. So I said yes to him. I then explained that every time I hear someone say, "I am Jewish and," the next words out of his mouth are some sort of insult to the South or to white people. Or he says that anybody who worries about the survival of the white race is a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews. And I said, after 40 years of this, I'm very, or 30 years, I think, at the time, I'm very, very sick of this. Now, there's a reason I said this. It has to do with appeals. If I had said, no, I'm not anti-Semitic, he could have gotten me up on a charge of having associated with many, many anti-Semites. Lord knows I associated with many, many anti-everybodies. But when I stated flatly that I was anti-Semitic, in an appeal, he would have an awful time. So what I call anti-Semitism is simply having a grudge against Jews. Nobody but me would say that they are an outright anti-Semite in that way. As a matter of fact, of course, my attitude toward Jews is, if you declare war on me, then we're at war. That seems simple enough. I know one Jew who is as fanatically, I remember we were standing together and he saw some little blonde girls walking by and he said, "You know, those are going to be the endangered species of our day. There are going to be no more blondes." And he was worried to death about it. Well, I can't really be angry at him. I can't be angry at Bernard Baruch's father, who was a Confederate colonel and who was the deputy surgeon general of the Confederacy, and when he went to New York and they played Dixie, he would stand up and scream to the great embarrassment of Bernard Baruch. "Well, please don't ask me to hate that guy. I'm from South Carolina." But when someone says, "I am Jewish and," it always means that he is anti-me, anti-white Gentile, anti-Southern. Therefore, I am anti-him. After Pearl Harbor, I think most Americans were anti-Japanese. This is a different thing from the present growth of anti-Semitism, which takes various other forms. But the fact is, there is a growth of anti-Semitism in the world. They are declaring war on my enemies, on the left and on the right. That is to say, on the extreme right. The only friends that Jews have today are the Old Testament Christians and the neoconservatives. Now, you see, I've gotten off into something that has no news hook, no importance in terms of frantic emailings, but something that is going to determine the future of the world. Henry Kissinger did state the present situation beautifully. Now, Henry Kissinger's family was in Austria when Hitler took over. Henry and his family got the hell out of there, but a lot of them stayed there and disappeared. So Kissinger is not really the greatest friend of anti-Semites, but what he said was about Jews. He said, "Any people that has been persecuted for 2,000 years is doing something wrong. Now, I'd rather have that statement as a statement of diplomatic wisdom than any news hook. The growing anti-Semitism in this world, the growing awareness that white people are being driven out of existence, these, to me, are important developments. They have nothing to do with Clinton with his pants down. They have nothing to do with Iraq. But they have everything to do with a true sophistication and a total lack of temporal provincialism.